Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, we'll hear how American evangelicals see biblical prophecy playing out on the world stage. But first, what to make of the freeing of American journalist Roxana Saberi, released from an Iranian jail in Tehran today after an appeals court suspended her 8-year sentence. Saberi has reported for various news outlets, including NPR and the BBC. She was convicted of spying on Iran for the U.S. in April in a trial that lasted only an hour. She denied those charges and went on a 2-week hunger strike, which recently ended, and the court heard her appeal today in a 5-hour session. Borzu Daragahi is Middle East correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Borzu, are you surprised at this quick reversal of her sentence?
Yeah, I am kind of surprised by it because of the severity of the charges and the kind of the corner the Iranian authorities had backed themselves into by making the charges so extreme, specifically gathering and passing intelligence to U.S. operatives. And so it stunned me a little bit.
So what do you think's going on here?
Well, I think there's a few different possibilities. One of them is that Iran's president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, is facing a real challenging re-election environment. He's got three political heavyweights challenging him for the presidency, and that's coming up June 12th, the vote. And this was seen by many as a distraction, as a kind of public relations black eye for Iran. You got to remember that Iran's government is not monolithic. There's a lot of different power centers. You had a situation here where one hand didn't really know or coordinate with the other hand what was happening. You could have had like the intelligence branch pursuing this woman while the presidency is kind of out of the loop and the judiciary is in the middle of it trying to mediate between the two factions.
Right. And we know that Ahmadinejad made an unusually strong public appeal for the appellate court to carefully review Saberi's case, kind of implying, gee, are you sure you're doing the right thing? So does this decision to suspend the sentence help Ahmadinejad in his reelection bid?
According to Iranian analysts that we've been speaking to, this will help because it's a public relations positive for him. It shows that he is capable of rational decisions that help Iran's interests internationally. And it also shows that he's still a heavyweight, that he has influence, that he can make this call and the system will respond.
Does it say anything bigger about the relationship between the U.S. and Iran, and especially between the new U.S. president and the Iranian president?
The whole episode shows the very challenging nature of the task on the part of both the Obama administration and moderates in Iran of improving relations between the two countries, because at any given moment, someone could do something that could sabotage that rapprochement.
Well, and Borzu, just one last question. How is this news being received by people like you, who have been going in and out of Iran reporting?
Well, I think it's great news. I'm friends with Roxana, so I'm very, very happy. I was very concerned about what would happen to her, and I'm delighted that she's getting her freedom and able to move on with her life after what was a very traumatic experience of being held in solitary confinement inside one of the most notorious prisons in the world.
Well, of course, everyone is thankful, and she'll have quite a story to tell. But does this mean that reporters can be a little more open? Does this say anything about reporting in Iran?
I am convinced that from the beginning of this case, it was never really about her reporting activities. I know that some judiciary and cultural ministry officials said that she was working without a press card and that was illegal. But I am convinced that it was not so much her press activities that got her in trouble as the suspicion that she was shuttling between embassies and going from this person's house to that person's house and having contacts with various government officials, you know, regardless of her journalism activities. I think that this case was always about something more than that. We're not quite sure what, but, you know, this is highly unusual for them to take someone who is obviously a legitimate journalist and make these charges against them. And it really kind of backfired in a way in terms of pursuing any kind of objective. You know, not only did they not thwart the Obama administration in its attempts at trying to improve the relations between the two countries and change the temperature, but it also ultimately didn't prove any point, as an appellate court simply suspended the sentence and is, you know, apparently sending her home.
Borza Dargahi, Middle East correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. We'll link you to his stories at hereandnow.org. Borzu, thanks so much.
It's my pleasure.
Well, Pope Benedict is in Israel today calling for an independent Palestinian state, a call that's making headlines there, and is sure to raise the concern of some evangelical Christians here in the U.S. About a quarter of Americans are evangelical Christians, and they hold a wide range of beliefs. But a new documentary focuses on the millions of evangelicals who see biblical prophecy unfolding in current world events.
When I turn on the television and I see what's happening either in Iraq or Israel, I don't look at what's happening with the hope that it will work out, because I see that there are certain things that have to happen for the world to be ready for the return of Christ.
The film is called Waiting for Armageddon. In it, evangelicals lay out their beliefs, from the rapture, the belief that they'll be snatched up and meet Christ in the air, to the tribulation, the hell on earth that follows below, to the final battle, Armageddon, which will be staged from land that must be in the hands of the Jews or their allies, land in the Middle East and in Iraq. And they believe that Armageddon is coming soon.
Do I believe that I will hold a grandchild? No. I just don't think we have that much time left.
Franco Sacchi is filmmaker in residence at the Center for Digital Imaging Arts here at Boston University, and he's co-director of Waiting for Armageddon. He joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And you're not an evangelical. What drew you to this topic?
Well, if someone asked me today, you know, in America, what is one of the most interesting phenomena on the political and on cultural landscape, I would say that if you really want to understand America in our age, you really have to take a look at the evangelical movement.
Well, and in your film, you let them lay out their beliefs in their own words, culminating in what the Bible calls Armageddon near Jerusalem,
Armageddon.
Now, evangelicals you speak with think that that battle is going to be fought with horses, just like the Bible says. They take everything literally. You show a scene where they discuss this in a scholarly way. Let's listen.
I think it's an actual battle with horses and conventional warfare of something that would have been true in the days of Christ. And because all the modern technology is useless at that point.
And there'll be some kind of a blast from Christ, but it doesn't have to be an atomic blast, because it's going to be selective. It's going to kill the attacking army, but not the Jews.
They really use the Bible as almost a map. You know, it's almost a code. And for them, it's very simple to read the Bible and see almost a very detailed prediction of the future. Technology will not be available at the time, the level of destruction.
Everything will be wiped out.
Everything, exactly. And computers will not work. We will go back. There is, I think, sometimes a little bit of a fascination in seeing our system and society collapsing and going back to basic fighting, you know, hand-to-hand almost.
Well, and you speak, for instance, with a couple in Connecticut, attractive, young, educated, smart. Let's listen.
Christ will come back with a sword on his side, and he will come back as the ultimate judge of the world. We're going to be behind him with, I believe, swords in our hands, and we're going to be his army. And this battle, the blood from this battle will be as high as a horse's bridle. It's just something mankind has never witnessed before.
By the way, why did you speak to them?
Well, they approached the Bible from a very, very rational point of view.
One was an engineer and one a software engineer.
Yes,
they build fighter planes, and so very rational people. And let's move now to the way they and others feel about Israel and Jews.
Well, the film ultimately focuses on the relationship between the evangelical movement and the Jewish people. And one of the characteristics of the evangelical is to put at the center of their theology Israel and the Jewish people, because they still have a role. For them, it's absolutely critical to support Israel as part of their theology.
Because they see Jews as God's chosen people. But then ultimately, it feels as if they see them as placeholders. Their job is to hold on to the land. What's the importance of the land? At one point, someone says it's not just that Israel has to remain a sovereign Jewish nation, but Jerusalem has to be under Israel's control.
Well, once you start reading the Bible in an extremely literal way, and if the Bible says that the Jewish people will come back and the land, the integrity of the land will be, you know, preserved, then you would oppose any peace process that would imply a two-state solution, for example, because that would be absolutely against the prophecy.
Well, in fact, they believe that as part of the prophecy, someone is going to sign a peace treaty with Israel, and he will be the Antichrist. So it's sort of a no-win situation. If someone does find peace with Israel, they're the Antichrist.
Yeah. It's really important to raise a certain awareness. I mean, Israel doesn't have a lot of friends, and I'm sure that, you know, they're always looking for support. But it's really important we raise the awareness. Where is the support coming from? And really engage the evangelical in. Yes, they would oppose a peace process that would, for example, consider a two-state solution, right, as I said. I really want to say that we did not make this film to attack the evangelical movement. The evangelical movement is very, you know, there are many aspects of it, and this is one aspect.
Well, in fact, you've been attacked for not doing that. you simply lay out their thinking, and you've been attacked for not being more critical of the thinking.
It is true, and I really think we need to get away from this confrontation with this movement. It's really important that the moderate part of the evangelical movement start engaging the more fundamentalist and have a conversation. So the reason why we make this film is because we really felt that we need to listen to our, you know, fellow Americans and evangelical brothers and sisters, and really pay attention. And if something seems so outrageous, well, we need to talk about it.
Well, let's do a little more of that listening. You follow a group of evangelicals on a study tour to Israel, and here's where we learn further about their belief that Jews must control Israel. They go to the Dome of the Rock. This is the sacred Al-Aqsa Mosque for Muslims. But it's also where Jews believe that their temple will return. They believe that there's a stone there, mm-hmm, from which God created the whole earth. Evangelicals back the Jews in their hope that a temple will return to that site so fervently that you hear evangelicals tell you that the mosque must go. Let's listen.
I don't know exactly how it's going to be removed, but it is not part of the end times as far as the Bible or Christianity is concerned. I don't think Judaism either. There's no place for that mosque. It has to be removed.
Dome of the Rock will somehow be done away with. I have no idea. There's been plenty of earthquakes up there that could solve it. I kept hoping one of Saddam's missiles would find its way over to the dome.
Well, now that gentleman told you later when he saw the film, I was really kind of kidding, but he really kind of wasn't. He takes photographs and airbrushes the mosque out and puts the temple in. You speak to many Jews in the film as well. They seem a little leery of this fervent support for them.
Yes, of course. One expert in particular is Gershon Gorenberg, who is the author of End of Times, a book on the Al-Aqsa Mosque and all the tensions around it. And clearly, to see these evangelicals come with this bravado, and we spent a lot of time with this group of evangelicals. They're really like good people, are your neighbors. But once we arrived on the mountain, there was a different attitude that for an Israeli, for a Jew who lives there and knows that it can be extremely dangerous.
Franco Sacchi, his film is Waiting for Armageddon. We'll hear more in 1 minute here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to Here and Now. We're speaking with filmmaker Franco Sacchi, whose new documentary, Waiting for Armageddon, traces the beliefs of evangelical Christians in the U.S. He follows a group of them on a popular tour through Israel. They go to Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem, the third holiest site in Islam, also the holiest site for Jews. It's where their first temple once stood, and where many believe a Messiah will return to a rebuilt temple to become the king of Israel. Well, as we see in Sacchi's film, many Christian fundamentalists support those Jews, but because they believe that at the height of Armageddon, a battle which they believe will kill all the Jews except those who convert, Christ will return to a rebuilt temple and begin a million-year reign. Well, in the documentary, we see the tour leader encourage evangelicals to get around a ban on Bibles by bringing in their Bible-loaded Palm Pilots to the mosque. And the tour leader speaks quite loudly about how Christ will return before he's shushed by his obviously embarrassed Jewish guide.
The buildings are all gone. Jesus didn't say, and after they finish the buildings, I'll take in the retaining walls.
When we talk, it's sensitive.
I'm sorry.
No, I mean it. When we talk about either Jewish temple or Christ in the temple and so on, things are quite sensitive here.
Oh, that's fine. Thank you.
Gershom Gorenberg, a Jewish end-of-days scholar, also speaks in the film about the danger of this clash of thinking.
When people think that they have to possess a place to possess the truth, that turns that spot into the blasting cap of religious conflict.
Well, filmmaker Franco Sacchi is quick to say American Christian evangelicals are benign compared to Muslim jihadists who crash planes into buildings. But his film leaves a question hanging. Do U.S. evangelicals do more than wish for biblical prophecy? Do they impact foreign policy? For instance, the war in Iraq, which these evangelicals see as playing a role in end times.
Circumstances in the world today seem to be really setting the stage, especially even what's happening right now in Iraq. The southern part of Iraq was ancient Babylon, and the city of Babylon plays a prominent role in the last days.
Yeah.
And so the stage appears to be set.
So, Franco Sacchi, this does leave the impression that the war in Iraq was waged to set the stage for the prophecies. You never say it directly, but you're nodding yes now. And in your film, we see evangelicals embracing born-again President Bush.
No. Clearly, once you accept this literal interpretation and you start, you know, following the Bible ahead in such a mechanical way, it's very easy to draw consequences based on, you know, your passion and political interest. And so a component, not all evangelicals, a component of the evangelical world is really caught into this. And I really think that the real divide in this moment, it's not between Christian and Muslims, it's between fundamentalist and moderate on each side. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, there is a large part of the evangelical movement that looks at the current events and with a certain of excitement, almost bravado, and almost, you know, desire to see this world end, and in some ways for a good reason.
And we should explain.
We
should explain because they believe that after that happens comes the millennium.
Yes.
Time of no evil, peace, loveliness, and they will participate in it. They yearn for it. But it just is a reminder that if someone is yearning for a time after the world ends, they don't have as much interest in bringing peace on earth now.
Exactly. It's almost a utopian, you know, vision. And I think sometimes utopian vision can be extremely dangerous because you tend to deny the reality and postpone all the problems after some supernatural event. So I think if this approach to religion within the evangelical movement really takes over almost and sets the tone, how are we going to solve our problems with the environment? How we look?
Why would you care about global warming?
It's very hard. It's really hard. And even though when we spoke with some of them, of course they want to see the world a better place. But the solution will come after all this horror and destruction. And in some ways, what gives many of the people we talk to, what gives them really hope is the sense that history is on the right course. And for them, seeing war and destruction means to be on the right course. So it's very problematic. And so the idea is if we have tens of millions of Americans who are very active in politics and in school boards, and they seem to be almost engulfed in this, the motives can be even pure. But we need to engage them and talk to them. And I think many of them will understand it, say, okay, maybe there is, you know, there is a way to talk to other Christians and other religions. And that was the hope of the film, to really raise a debate and really listen.
They've seen the film, these people that you worked with in the film. What did they think of it?
Overall, I think they really did recognize our intent, that was to give a voice to this movement. And they really understood that our intention was not to ridicule or attack them. And they gave us, I guess, a C-plus in theology.
Well, a lot of it's out of their mouths. So, but it does seem like the kind of film that someone might watch and, you know, be drawn to the faith or be repelled by the thinking, which means you've done your job.
Thank you very much.
Franco Sacchi, a filmmaker in residence at the Center for Digital Imaging Arts at Boston University, but also one of the directors of the film Waiting for Armageddon. Franco, thanks so much for speaking to us about it.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
And by the way, Waiting for Armageddon will be released theatrically by First Run Features. That's in the fall. Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, we're going to go inside the heads of Muslim fundamentalists with author Reza Aslan, who says they are also on a mission, but they're fighting a cosmic war.
A cosmic war is a war in which participants believe they're acting out on Earth a battle that's actually taking place in heaven. It's a war of the imagination, a war in which the warriors on Earth are essentially nothing more than pawns in the hands of God or actors in a divine script written before time.
That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, the quirky filmmakers, the brothers Quay. That's after the news, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The White House is calling it a game changer for health care reform. Doctors, drug companies, insurers, and hospital reps met with President Obama this morning and pledged to cut up to $2 trillion in health care costs over the next 10 years. Administration officials said that would mean a savings of $2,500 for the average family of four by 2014. And the president says he hopes the savings will help him fund health care for the 50 million uninsured Americans. Gail Chadwick is senior congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. And Gail, take us through this. First of all, the industry has said some of the savings will come from preventative care, cutting unnecessary procedures, standardizing insurance forms, moving towards electronic medical records. But are they giving specifics?
We may know more by the end of the day. The president may tell us more just about this time. But I think the biggest issue is how committed are the lobby groups, the AMA, the hospital associations, America's health insurance plans, unions, to actually making those cuts? It's not clear how they're going to divvy them up among each other. But I think there is a lot of confidence in especially electronic records. A lot of waste, and everyone can agree that waste is bad, and there's a commitment to invest heavily by the federal government in getting electronic records going. So I think of all of them, that's the most promising. Preventing obesity, that's another item under prevention. Ask your viewers, listeners, how inclined you are to dramatically change how you eat. That's a basic, too, eat and exercise in prevention.
Well, I want to
are hoping there'll be a lot of savings from.
Well, I want to jump in there because, as you said, there's criticism of the plan. You know, how is it monitored? It's only a pledge. But also, even President Obama, in a recent New York Times article, confessed that he and his family authorized a $20,000 hip operation on his grandma and when he knew his grandma was dying. In other words, it's something that under this pledge, hospitals are going to be asked to say, you know, think about not giving that $20,000 operation to someone who may not benefit from it. So there's a lot of questions about how exactly this is going to work.
No, exactly. And this is, you know, there was a very interesting briefing on the Hill last week that was immediately leaked, and we all feel like we were actually in the room even though it was closed. This was Frank Luntz, who's a pollster and a Republican advisor, talking to Republicans about how to try to influence this outcome. And he said, you've got to think about the words that you use, words like deny care, ration care. by Washington bureaucrats. He apparently told Republicans that he didn't think they could influence very much, but they could derail this program, this health care reform, if they emphasize those concepts enough.
Yeah. And by the way, why did these groups meeting with Obama today meet with him and accept the pledge? Because these are some of the same groups that helped scuttle health care reform in the 90s under President Bill Clinton.
I think there is a very broad sense across the industry that the increase in health costs now is simply unsustainable. You know, you go back to the days of the Harry and Louise ad when the Clinton administration tried to do this. We're now talking about costs that are increasing from $2.4 trillion, that's 17% of the national economy, to $4.4 trillion in just 10 years. Health costs alone are by far the biggest driver in national deficits. And so there's a sense that if they did not agree, Congress is going to do something, and better to influence the outcome than to have to deal with it when Congress presents you with it.
Well, and just in the minute we have, where are we then on health care legislation?
I think you're going to see something move very rapidly. The Senate is closing in on the last of its roundtables tomorrow on how to pay for this. Now, it's going to help a lot that the industry has just said, we've got you covered for about $2 trillion you don't have to come up with. But I think they're looking to get some legislation on the floor, certainly by Memorial Day and out by the summer.
Gail Chadwick, Senior Congressional Correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And in half a minute, we'll see how Obama did at his first White House Correspondents' Dinner this past weekend. Back in about half a minute. Here and now. Okay, you're about to hear a sound that's music to the ears of users of the popular TiVo digital video recorder, or DVR. Ah, that's what people hear when they fast forward past commercials. The TiVo allows people to record shows and skip commercials, but now TiVo and other DVRs are wedging commercials back in to try to stop the hemorrhaging of ad revenue, which is expected to drop $45 billion or 75% over the next 10 years. Here now, media analyst and Boston University mass communication professor John Carroll joins us. And John, TiVo used to really upset television executives because it, as we said, allowed users to skip commercials. Now it's putting them back in. How?
Well, it still does upset network television because basically, according to one survey, 85% of TiVo watchers zap three-quarters of the ads. So they're looking at some way to change the experience with advertising. And what they're doing right now is when you're doing something other than watching the show, in other words, you pause or you fast forward, they are trying to get a message up on the screen to engage you, to get you to push a different button to find out information or to go back and to watch an ad that you may have been skipping because there's some inherent interest in it.
So TiVo, new destination for advertisers. Tell us more, though, about how it looks. So you're TiVoing through, you're fast-forwarding, you hit pause. What happens?
And a text block comes up on the screen that says, do you want to know about this? Or if you're fast-forwarding, it says, oh, you just missed the Australia ad with the gals in bikinis. Don't you want to go back and watch it? So basically what they're trying to do is to stop people and somehow engage them in some way. This is the future of advertising, is the interactivity of it.
Well, in this case, who makes the money? In other words, do the advertisers pay TiVo to put something up when the pause hits, or do the networks get it?
It's a revenue-sharing arrangement. I mean, for the most part, when you have these kinds of arrangements, the content provider gets the larger share, the distributor gets the smaller share. So on the Internet, for instance, it's usually a 70-30 split.
Well, let's talk about cable companies before we move to the Internet, because we know they're now also offering ads during Fast Forward. Is another appeal for advertisers that they can also maybe do things that are more creative in this new interactive form than they can in a 30-second ad?
Every advertiser wants, at this point, to get into a conversation with the consumer. And this is what the cable companies are trying to offer. They're trying to say, look, we can get your foot in the door. And after that, it's up to you. Advertisers think that's a very valuable road to go down. And they're looking to do it in as many ways as they can.
Really? I mean, are there advertisers who might be hesitating, saying, well, how many eyeballs are you really going to deliver me?
There's a skepticism about this right now because it's untested. But I think any advertiser who has two brain cells to rub together has to know that you've got to get into these things now. The traditional 30-second spot is going the way of the buggy whip. It's just it's not going to survive. It's still the best way to get a mass message out there, to mass market, but it's not as effective as it was before.
You know what? I feel I have to say a buggy whip is something that was used in a horse and buggy. We've been having this conversation a lot that we have to explain old phrases to young people and new phrases to older people. Let's look at the internet. A new phrase there, Hulu. This is a company that provides television shows online. We know the migration of people from television to watching shows on the internet. So tell us about Hulu and what's happening there.
Hulu is an online video service that was started by NBC Universal and News Corp, Rupert Murdoch's group. And basically what they did was they got a number of content providers together. It's up to about 150 now. And they are offering complete programs and movies online, advertising supported. Mm-hmm. So at this point, Hulu, a year old, is either the third or the fifth most watched online video service on the internet now.
And Disney has struck a deal with them?
Disney just jumped on board for a percentage of the company, an equity stake. They have given their content over as well. So they're going to have a lot of their shows, Lost, Desperate Housewives, that kind of thing. They're going to unlock the fabled Disney vault and bring some things out that are not available on cable and make them available on the internet. So they have a number of different ways. And so does NBC and so does News Corp. I mean, they have their own network internet sites and video sites, but basically Hulu is a place where people can go and have a very easy experience of video, and more people are drifting that way.
And we remind ourselves Disney is ABC, so there is a lot of content there. But Hulu had 380 million viewers in March. YouTube has more than 10 times those users, 5.9 billion. It's really quite astonishing. So do you think Hulu will be able to catch up with YouTube or maybe get wiped out because of YouTube's success?
Now, I think Hulu's got something that YouTube doesn't, which is a very advertiser-friendly environment. And I think that advertisers are gravitating toward that. Hulu charges more for advertising than YouTube does. YouTube brings in about $200 million a year in advertising. Hulu brought in $120 million. So even though YouTube has more than 10 times as many views, the advertising revenue is going to get closer and closer because Hulu doesn't have the downside that YouTube does. Advertisers look at YouTube and they say, this is the Wild West, and I'm not sure I want my ad cheek by jowl with the cat and a dog video. And so what Hulu offers is a very reliable, very traditional, very buttoned-down environment for
Looks
advertisers
like television.
To go to.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's entirely controlled by Hulu as opposed to being consumer-generated content, which is something that is completely unreliable.
And Hulu and other web-based video services, you can't skip the ads that are on those services as you can with TiVo. That's one thing. So advertisers might like that. But what's the possible downfall of this? Because you speak of Disney giving away a lot of this product. And don't we understand that that's what happened to sort of doom newspapers? They just kept putting more and more things online, not charging for it, hoping to make the money with advertising revenue. It didn't work.
No, it didn't work for newspapers. And in many ways, networks are thinking they wish they had a way to make this paid content. But the corn is off the cob at this point. I mean, basically, this is not going to reverse itself. They still do provide, a number of the networks provide downloads from iTunes for a price. But you can get a download that's portable. You can get a download that has no commercial interruption. So some people will pay for that. But for the most part, I think it's too late to look for a paid model.
Do you see, John Carroll, the television set going the way of the landline?
To some degree. I mean, there's a younger generation that doesn't watch television. They watch television shows online. This idea of a family hearth, the electronic hearth, is something that is disappearing more and more from a younger generation. And what they're doing is it's mobile, it's customizable, and it's instantaneous for them. So those are the qualities that they value as opposed to the family hour when you all sit and watch television together.
That's Here Now media analyst and Boston University mass communication professor John Carroll on new ways that broadcast television is trying to create ad revenue, get you to look at advertising. John, thanks so much.
Nice to be here, Robin.
Well, in case you didn't tape it for later watching, here are a few highlights from this weekend's White House Correspondents Association dinner. President Obama's first.
I am Barack Obama. most of you covered me. All of you voted for me.
He soon added, with apologies to the Fox table, Obama also explained why his daughters couldn't attend.
Now, Sasha and Malia aren't here tonight because they're grounded. You can't just take Air Force One on a joyride to Manhattan. I don't care whose kids you are.
Conservative talk show host Rush Limbaugh didn't attend either, but comedian Wanda Sykes weighed in on his statement that he hoped the Obama administration would fail.
To me, that's treason. He's not saying anything differently than what Osama bin Laden is saying. You know, you might want to look into this, sir, because I think maybe Rush Limbaugh was the 20th hijacker, but he was just so strung out on Oxycontin he missed his flight.
Sykes then turned to the president and asked, too much? Well, former Vice President Dick Cheney can't get enough of Rush Limbaugh. Speaking on CBS's Face the Nation this past weekend, he said he'd choose Limbaugh over former Secretary of State Colin Powell to lead the Republican Party. Cheney said of Powell, I didn't know he still was a Republican. Back after a break with the quirky filmmakers, the Quay Brothers, you're listening to Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Here and Now. For 30 years, the brothers Timothy and Stephen Quay have been producing some of the weirdest, creepiest, and most beautiful little movies. Director Terry Gilliam called their short Street of Crocodiles one of the 10 best animated films ever. The Quays painstakingly create mysterious, miniature, Victorian-style worlds populated by broken dolls and debris. The results leave audiences awestruck and scratching their heads. A new exhibit in Boston pulls back the curtain on how the brothers do what they do. Here Now's Andrea Shea visited the installation and talked with the quirky Quays.
The Quay brothers have made a career out of conjuring surreal illusions. Their new exhibition, called Dormitorium, features 11 decors, or sets, the stop-motion animators designed and built themselves for more than 24 short films and features. The decors arrive at the Fourth Wall Gallery, packed in sturdy travel cases. Curator Lucy Aptekar opens one up and peers inside a box made of molded wood and glass. She calls it a vitrine.
It takes you back to thinking about what it felt like as a child to look into a dollhouse.
A haunted dollhouse, perhaps, or a cabinet of curiosity. Phantom museums that have a Victorian feel and sort of musty look. Aptekar wonders at the objects inside, the puppets, the tiny bookcases, a glove, and especially the lint.
I can't recall another film where something as infinitesimally small as lint is used as a fundamental character.
Who would do that? Stephen and Timothy Quay would do it, that's who.
Brett Michel is a film critic for the Boston Phoenix. In college, he discovered the Quay brothers' short film Street of Crocodiles on VHS.
I quite literally just wore that tape out. That tape is just destroyed.
But the effects of that one little film haven't worn off.
Oh, 20 years later, and I'm still knocking it around in my head. There's just this surreal quality. You know, there are dolls that are moving around and dissecting themselves. And, you know, there's uses of meat. Boy, it's best to be experienced than explained.
Crocodiles is bizarre and impressionistic. The Quay brothers made it in 1986 in London, where the American-born identical twins have lived and worked since the late 1960s. In case you're wondering, they look alike, sound alike, seem to think alike, and even finish each other's sentences.
It's really a process of discovery, where the studio becomes like a laboratory. Nobody's looking, and it's just the two of us working on our own. So I think, in that sense, that it's a journey.
That journey takes the brothers out to the streets to find objects to populate their films. Straight pins, rusty screws, old spoons, and countless pairs of scissors.
I think it's what we've always liked about the street markets.
Antique markets in general.
Markets in general. Is the way people lay things out on their table. And a lot of times there's these wonderful chance encounters where one object is placed against another and we both arrive and we see it together and we both wink and say, look, you know it's good. But the person who's laid it out, he doesn't, it's unconscious.
Yeah, it's unconscious.
Marvelous. You go, it's telling a story.
The Quays set their sometimes grotesque stories in what they call a degraded reality. They've been dedicated to this aesthetic from the get-go, using freakish handmade puppets as actors. In Street of Crocodiles, they move around in what could be a nightmare version of Prague. To bring it all to life, the Quays use lighting and intimate camera work. They shoot frame by frame. Like a ballet, the action is set to music, which drives the drama. The Quays don't use dialogue in their shorts, including crocodiles, but the 21-minute film is filled with unusual sounds. A central object is a mechanized device that stretches and snaps rubber bands.
It's like it's a very banal machine. You think, must have some kind of symbolic function, but and it does and then it isn't. It's also, it is what it is, but when the sound realm got put to it, it then took it much, much further, pushed it out in a much more darker,
hallucinatory.
Yeah, disturbing realm, and I think if you're alert and you're open to what sound can do, then it does an immense amount of work for you.
Larry Sider edited the sound and music in Crocodiles and has worked with the Quays ever since. He says the brothers wanted this film to feel distant, as if the action was unfolding behind glass.
So you're always straining a little bit to hear things. Everything's not made easy for you. You're having to look, you're having to listen. You have to be an active audience with a Quay film to try to interpret what you're seeing and hearing.
After 30 years of collaborating with the Quays, Sider says he's given up on figuring out what their films mean, and he still marvels at what they do.
It's really very, very hard work. It's very physical work. They are fabricating things. It's not just sitting at a computer and pressing buttons back and forth.
And then there's the light that we're using.
The Quays exhibition pulls back the curtain to give the public a glimpse into what the artists do, but the brothers have mixed feelings about seeing their dolls out of their element.
They lack the motivation that they have in a film where the lighting is absolutely correct and they have movement to justify their life, but sometimes I get the feeling that if there's too much light on them, they suffer.
For the next 2 weeks, curator Lucy Aptekar will take care of the Quays dolls and decors. She says she's fascinated by the macabre fairy tales that unfold in each one.
Every individual wonders about their own dark side. We're afraid of it. We try to push it away. And the Quay brothers keep coming back to us with dreams and nightmares that may not be so easy to look at, but we can't resist.
Here Now's Andrea Shea produced our story on the Quay Brothers, whose exhibit, Dormitorium, runs through May 21st at the Fourth Wall Gallery here in Boston, then moves on. So to get the whole tour and to see excerpts from the Quays films, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.